is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud. Well, we had the 2019 election results. That kind of was a bit of a bang and then a whimper, I guess, with that. Of course, the whistleblower, the hearings that are supposed to be now publicized out there for our consumption. If you're interested in that, that will begin here this coming week. It's a crazy story, people. Just one more in the chapter of the Trump administration and a presidency that they are trying to pull down. Also, you know, interesting piece, lawyers in Congress. It's a system doomed to fail. And then corruption and death at the border. You see that horrific, horrific story of the cartels in Mexico there. That has wide-reaching ramifications here. You see President Trump reaches out to Mexico to offer a hand. They say no thank you. Big segment on that as well, people. I want to start here and talk to you about something I find very interesting. You know, in an age of what we call fake news, there's also kind of hard to decipher the lines, people, between fake news and satire and real news, of course. But I want to bring you to a very interesting satire piece from one that you all know, the Borowitz Report. So I don't really have to say any more than that in the New Yorker. But this is interesting. And it's worth a minute of our time. Let me read this to you here. The headline is, Bloomberg offers Trump $10 billion to leave the White House by the end of the day. So it goes on to say the former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg upended the 2020 presidential race on Friday by offering Donald J. Trump $10 billion to leave the White House by the end of the day. I will deposit $10 billion into your account in Moscow or Riyadh or wherever you do your banking these days, Bloomberg announced. All you have to do is go. In addition to the $10 billion offer, Bloomberg told Trump that he would cover the moving expenses of Ivanka, Jared, Kellyanne, and any other associates that you haven't gotten rid of. It concludes this way here, people. On Capitol Hill, congressional Democrats expressed sadness that Bloomberg's offer is, if successful, would eliminate the need for impeachment, which many of them had been looking forward to. But Representative Adam Schiff of California struck a more philosophical note. He says, if $10 billion gets rid of Donald Trump, that's a quid pro quo I'm okay with. I think that is a priceless, priceless news article. That may be more true, actually, than the real news. And let's get started right here. Next, people to welcome on here, Michael Johns. Michael is the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement, a former White House speechwriter, and a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Joining us back again here, Ava Armstrong is here. She's a political commentator, radio personality, and a best-selling author. Her books are on Amazon or the America Out Loud bookstore, of course. Okay, so I start there with that kind of, you know, we call it satire, but, you know, there's a lot of truth in comedy, isn't there? But the real news in this is that Michael Bloomberg, he looks like he's going to run for the presidency. Interesting. Michael Bloomberg is one of those characters that you don't really know what political circle to fit him into. Who does he hurt more, the Democrats or the Republicans, Michael?
Indisputably, he's going to hurt Democrats more. I mean, he's announced that he's going to, pursue Democrat nomination. He's not going to be, because of the late nature of his candidacy, able to enter the first four primaries in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, or South Carolina. And yet, as a multi-billionaire, he's going to bring extraordinary resources. I think you're going to see an unusual campaign on his end. It won't be very grassroots oriented. It's going to be very Super Tuesday oriented.
They say he's going after Super Tuesday. Yeah, that's his focus.
Yeah,
right, because it's kind of late in the game.
Super Tuesday is always about political advertising. Mm-hmm. He'll be able to buy a lot of it. And I think conventional wisdom is right that his, the primary loser in all this is Joe Biden, in the sense that, right, you know, Bloomberg is a liberal, but the point is, he's not uniformly liberal. I mean, he supported stop and frisk in New York City, which is absolutely antithetical to the far left. Mm-hmm. He has he's offered support for charter schools, which of course is completely alienating to the teachers union, which has been a foundation of traditional Democrat support.
Well, he's an interesting political character, you have to both agree, because he doesn't fit into one peg, really.
Well,
you
know, I don't think he's particularly dynamic. I don't think he's very compelling. Right. I don't think his ideology fits completely into what the progressive left.
Yeah, no. I mean, come on. He's got enough money to buy a state himself. I mean, come on. He's ultimately very, very wealthy. I also heard reports, by the way, Ava, that I don't know how true these are, because all kinds of things being said. It's not the first time I heard this either, that Eric Holder maybe is thinking about re-entering the race. So what's happening? Are a lot of these Democrat leaders looking at the left and they don't like the list of candidates that are there?
That's exactly what's happening. I think Democrats are realizing they have nothing for a field, and Bloomberg is sort of coming in on his white horse. Mm-hmm. Bloomberg, to me, is what I would call a limousine liberal, okay? Mm-hmm. He's lived his whole life in his billionaire luxury lifestyle. Very similar to de Blasio, really. Bloomberg's the type of guy who would make a really great dictator. Because he's already banned the big Slurpees and, you know,
just like de Blasio, they would be that'd be
this
a great freaking threat.
This is what these guys are all about. Yeah. They don't understand the big picture. The big picture just has them telling you what to do and them taking all your money, basically. That's it.
Yeah, we call that socialism, by the way. That's a definite version of that. another thing here that really caught a lot of eyes open up is Jeff Sessions wants his old job back. And he's got ads out there. He's in the run-ins here. And he says, the first campaign ad he puts out there, by the way, Ava, says, "Trump has my strong support." What do you think? Do you think Sessions has a chance for that Alabama seat, Ava?
I'm recusing myself from this.
I love it. Michael, what do you think? Do you think Sessions has a chance for that seat?
I think it's improbable that he's going to win Trump's endorsement, and yet Alabama is probably the most conservative state in the country.
Wow.
I think it's ripe for Republicans to take back. Mm-hmm. You have three or four candidates in that race. They're all compelling. And of course, he does have name recognition, and I think is looked upon fondly among in Alabama. The problem, of course, mm-hmm. is that as a attorney general, he was not perceived to be successful. I mean,
he was very weak
on the most important issue confronting the Justice Department.
Right.
He was forced to recuse himself. And that recusal led to a 2-year complete diversion of the American people at great expense of policy progress that could have been made and a great expense of the president.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he didn't come across as a strong attorney general. That is going to waver in big time here. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in this Alabama thing. Listen, I want to touch briefly on the election 2019 results. If you followed the media headlines and all, you'd think that President Trump, you'd think the Republicans had lost their shirts in it, as the media had reported. There was a lot of those stories going on. But let me ask you straight out, Michael, very specific. What can really, I mean, if you look at all these races here, but Virginia, Mississippi, and Kentucky, what can they tell us about 2020?
Well, it wasn't as bad of a day for Republicans as was widely reported. I mean, there's disproportionate attention placed on the Kentucky gubernatorial race. Even in that case, I mean, Bevin lost by 0.4%.
I know.
And you know, if you really look into it in more granular detail, you had a Libertarian candidate there who took, I think, almost 2% of the race. So if that Libertarian candidate had not been in the race, he would have won. Simultaneously, it would be the first African-American Republican who was elected Attorney General in Kentucky. That's hugely encouraging. And then if you go down the rest of these states, which did not receive as much attention, you've got, you know, forced runoff in Louisiana, which is, I think, going to have a very good possibility of going Republican, and a very well-funded Democrat in Mississippi in the Attorney General there, Jim Hood, who was defeated 52-46%. Virginia didn't go well. But then you had a few other high points for Republicans. I mean, also not widely reported. Republicans picked up a few seats in New Jersey, state Senate and state House.
Sure, that's right.
And which is you know, a liberal
unheard
state
of.
But there's
a lot of
unease with the tax and spend approach of New Jersey Democrats, and particularly the effect it's having on property values there. And then you had, I thought importantly, in Tucson, which is probably the most liberal city in Arizona, a complete rejection of the sanctuary city referendum, which shows that the American people continue to look disfavorably on that approach, and that is such a centerpiece
That's
of
a good
Democrats
point.
On the national level.
Yeah, it's a good point to Tucson, because that would have been the first market in Arizona to have gone that way. Would have not been a good thing, obviously, for freedom.
But one final observation I have, which I thought was really important, is, you know, the president was out with a lot of, you know, he was very aggressive in support of Republican candidates the last few weeks, and some of the polling of his campaign rallies were I thought really encouraging. They showed that up to a quarter of those attending were actually Democrats. So it continues to show that the president has a compelling cross appeal from a partisan standpoint.
And that's going to be important if 2020 is going to be successful. That is very much going to be important. So listen, sorry. So if you recap what Michael just put out there, so obviously Virginia is a total blue state now. It's no longer a toss-up anymore. That went, I mean, so far blue. You had some successes in New Jersey, says. You hear the rest of the pieces here. Ava, real quickly here, 538. They say this, the party's performance relative to partisanship can tell us which way the political winds might be blowing, and obvious trends from 2019, like the widening urban-rural divide. They provide clues as to where the battles of 2020 will be fought. What do you think?
I'm very concerned about that. There's a site called Flippable. Democrats are looking to flip certain states. Actually, they'd like to flip every state. And they actually have a very designed approach to do so. And I hope to God that Republicans are as well shaped up for battle as these Democrats are. They're looking at very local races. They're working from a grassroots level up. And that's exactly what Republicans need to be doing as well.
Yeah, they're very strategic in nature, as you say, and there's a lot to that. But let's move on here with the stories, and I want to talk to you both about the AKA whistleblower, which that word is odd in itself, because many are calling him more of a leaker, or there are a lot of other adjectives being used as well. But listen, two things I want to say to you all right now. There are two big Washington secrets, and everybody knows there's nothing secret in Washington, but there are two big secrets. Number one, the whistleblower's identity is a CIA analyst, Democrat operative. That's that one big secret. The second secret is there is an entire cabal that is plotting to overthrow the president. All they ever needed was the right scheme. So what they've done is been looking for this scheme, and I think those are the two secret non-secrets that we know, Michael, that are very clear when it comes to this whistleblower. Now, the attorneys for the whistleblower sent a cease and desist letter to the White House counsel telling President Trump to stop attacking his client and the public without saying his name, of course. Very odd. A lot of other things have happened in the public purview here over the past couple of weeks here. Social media has been acting very odd. Facebook's removing any mention of the whistleblower's name and is cracking down. I mean, everybody seems to know who this is, except the ones who don't want to really identify it out of some means of protocol or whatever. Then there are those very ominous tweets, Michael, going back away from Mark Zaid, the attorney there of the whistleblower. They were quite telling. And that he said back in 2017 that a coup has started and that impeachment will follow ultimately. And he goes on to say in another tweet in July, I predict at CNN will play a key role in at real Donald Trump not finishing out his full term as president, which many people have predicted, by the way. And of course, they're losing time on the clock if that's going to happen, Michael. He says, and let me leave it here. This is what he finishes up with. We will get rid of Trump. And this country is strong enough to survive even him and his supporters. What do you say to that, Michael?
Well, it reconfirms, I think, in the eyes of anyone paying attention, that this is not a matter of the rule of law. This is not a matter of a high crime or misdemeanor, which would reach the impeachment threshold. This is an indisputably partisan attack that's being launched by a partisan CIA operative and his attorney, who has a long-standing record, as you correctly point out, of deriding the president and seeking his removal. So again, like the Russia investigation, the goal here is not to sort of get to some truth or to have transparency or even about accountability in government. Those are all important things. Those are all things that we would all, I think, defend. They're more important than even any partisan defense wherever you are in, you know, as far as party allegiances or as far as where you are with this president. But importantly, the so-called whistleblower has a long partisan association. He was an Obama appointee. He went to Adam Schiff before he went to the IG. And as far as his name goes, and the release of his name, I don't think it's terribly important that it be reported. It's not a household name. It's not someone that, that most people would recognize. But Democrats have that wrong too. The whistleblower statute provides anonymity for the purposes of the IG. The IG is to protect the anonymity. It doesn't preclude media, Congress, other entities from disclosing it. And the point that I think many Republican, House Republicans particularly, have been making, which is reasonable, is if you're going to seek to pull down a duly elected president of the United States, it might be sort of a good idea that we know who you are and what your background is.
You think, huh? Wow. The other interesting thing about this Zeid attorney, Ava, is that he promised that the coup would occur in many steps. Now, House GOP Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, says we should take Zeid at his word that this is a coordinated, premeditated plot to overturn the election. What do you think?
Oh, it's so obvious. Yes, it is. And the thing that's really striking to me is this is how the Democrats operate. I have deja vu from the Kavanaugh hearing, okay? When I'm watching all of what's going on right now, it's no different than what they did to Justice Kavanaugh during his hearings. And I am just, it makes me sick to my stomach, to be honest with you, to see law and order turned on its head. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're looking for, you already have the crime in your mind that you want. Now you're looking for fake evidence to use to support it. And that's not how our system works.
But Ava, hasn't that not been their strategy from the beginning, though? If you think about everything that's happened so far, they have been in search for the crime every single time.
I don't know how anybody can be a Democrat anymore. I really don't, because this is so blatant. It's so blatantly dishonest and so blatantly illegal what they're doing.
No, and there's no underlying wrongdoing is the important point here. I mean, the transcript was fully released by the White House. The transcript urged cooperation with Ukraine on a Department of Justice investigation. There ultimately was no quid pro quo, which, by the way, the history of foreign aid is a history of quid pro quos. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we were going to impeach every president who had a quid pro quo in a foreign aid project, you would have impeached every president since the end of World War II.
That's a great point.
And finally, the aid was released, was it not? So, I mean, ultimately, the discussion did not lead to any withholding of that aid, and there's been nothing forthcoming from Ukraine.
Well, I think what they're doing, part of the strategy, Michael, is the more they dig up, the more they try to pry, the more they try to get into people's minds, they're looking for some sort of a smoking gun, something they can turn onto the public, say, ha-ha, we gotcha. And that's kind of what's been going on since before day number one. Every one of these catastrophes have been that
way. The smoking gun, though, starts with this question. What was Joe Biden's son doing for the millions of dollars that he was paid by a Ukrainian petroleum company to represent them? And what exactly did he do for those millions of dollars? He had no history of expertise in energy or in
but did you see that they have put him on as a witness? The GOP has asked him to be a witness in there, Hunter Biden.
But the unfortunate structure of this is that House Republicans don't really have the leverage to be arranging this objectively. So
no, but they put it out there.
Witnesses, obviously he should be called. He should probably be witness number one. And those questions he put directly to them. Yeah. Obviously, he was retained because of his familial relationship with political power at that time and his father.
Did either of you see this story that Adam Schiff accidentally leaked the name of the anti-Trump whistleblower in Bill Taylor's transcript, and that after they caught the error, they pulled the transcript from the House website? Did either of you hear that?
Yes. And also this so-called leaker, whistleblower, whatever you want to call him, he's also a footnote in the Mueller report. So this guy has been right there from the beginning, okay? This was all a setup.
Yeah, but there's other names being thrown out too. Ava, identify, who is he?
Well, he's Eric Ciaramella. His background is CIA, so, you know, he's been all involved in the government.
He's a career CIA analyst, and he was the Ukraine director on the National Security Council at the very end of the Obama administration.
Political appointment. That's not a civil government appointment. Meaning Obama considered his viewpoints and his outlook aligned with his own vision on Ukraine and Russia, which is why he was on the NSC staff to begin with.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, you get to a point, like Michael says there a moment ago here, like, does any of this really matter? It only matters in the context that we make it matter when they put these kinds of scandals out there. What's happening is, what I think the GOP has always left to, what's been happening over the last 3 years, is they're constantly playing defense. Part of the strategy here, people, is they need to play offense. And part of that offense is calling some of these witnesses and really giving Schiff a hard time. They've also asked him to be a witness, by the way, in the impeachment trial. We know none of that's going to happen because he's controlling the cards. But at the very end of the day, hopefully a lot of this will showcase how ridiculous this whole thing is. Let's move the ball on here. I want to talk to you, Michael, stay with you a moment, talk to you about China. They have agreed with the U.S. to cancel the existing tariffs. And now Trump says he's open to lifting some, but not all. China, of course, is asking for everything, which is what they always ask for. But the president said he won't do a total repeal of tariffs on roughly about $360 billion in Chinese goods. In fact, Trump's words are, he says, they'd like to have a rollback. I haven't agreed to anything. China would like to get somewhat of a rollback, not a complete rollback, because they know I won't do it, is what he said just the other day here. And he said China would like to make a deal more than I would. What do you think's going on here?
I think he's right that China wants and needs the deal more than the U.S. does. It's an export-driven economy. There's been an extraordinary hit to the Chinese economy, partly because of the tariffs, but partly because of some of the, you know, illogical centralized approaches that continue to dominate their economic vision. And you have, you know, GDP sort of descending now into single digits. Remember back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they were talking about, you know, China, you know, 15% GDP. You have consumer prices rising extensively. Inflation reports out this week on China show that, you know, the consumer products, particularly in, you know, food and other really hugely important areas, are beginning to skyrocket. There's some real structural problems in the Chinese economy, and they desperately need these tariffs lifted. I think the other point is that China sort of wants this incremental approach to the negotiations, where it's done in a series of steps, as opposed to the original vision, which was to sort of put all of these issues, you know, subsidy of industry, the forced technology transfer, for the lack of respect for intellectual property rights, the tariffs that are placed on our own exports, right, to China, put all of that on the table at the same time and work all of that out. You know, I think it's a little less certain when you do it incrementally. It's probably okay to do it that way. But ultimately, you know, this is a presidential decision. I don't know where it sort of leaked out or was considered to be something under consideration right now. But the president reaffirmed the Thursday or Friday that, you know, there's no current consideration of lifting those trade sanctions until these issues
Right, because once he says uncle and he gives in, then all bets are off again, and we're back to square one, Michael, is what happens. And
yeah, I mean, the markets really want a resolution to this issue. Yeah. It's probably the most driving factor right now behind it. There's a lot of, you know, it's good. The international economy really wants, these are the two largest economies in the world. And yet, I think what the president's done. And what the reason it's so hugely important is that we have had 30 or 40 years of neglect of these issues.
Easy. You know,
and if the current trade deficit with China doesn't concern you at the current levels, like when it will, it, when will the alarms go off? You know,
that's
when
right.
it's $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion, what, how many industries, how many jobs have to leave?
I mean, listen, all of our trade deals are upside down backwards. And that's one of the things that you have to acknowledge as president. You know, sometimes you have to take a couple of steps back before you move forward. And the president has acknowledged that in a very unique way. Most previous administrations have ignored these kinds of problems because they're big problems that have been building for decades. They didn't happen yesterday. Two points here I want to say on this thing, Ava. One is, even if this happens with China, two problems here. How do we get them to comply with the terms of an agreement, which they typically have a history of not complying to their agreements, number one? That's a problem with a lot of countries, but big problem with China. And number two, I mean, like, even if something happens and the president, I mean, right now we got the USMCA that is completely stalled in the House of Representatives for the last year because Pelosi doesn't want any political gain. And so she holds the entire, you know, our entire economy and base at realm. Think about the progress in that USMCA deal happening. But the same thing could happen here. She would stall any progress here with China as well.
Yes, and I'm sure she's using that as a bargaining chip. That's the type of person that she is. It's all about her, not about the health of the country. I love President Trump's, you know, the way that he's devised this whole thing. At first, he sent in Wilbur Ross, and then he sent in Lighthizer, and now he's sending in Mnuchin to do the work. But this will get done. Nobody really understands how determined President Trump really is. He looks at a problem from many different angles. He's not like the typical presidents we've had in the past.
Okay, so listen, let's talk next about Congress and the makeup of Congress. It's interesting when you look at Democrats and Republicans in this body here, certainly the most influential political body in the world, and the amount of attorneys. Interesting story coming up next, people. Was this always a system doomed to fail? Stay right there. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
So listen, as we join you back here, I grew up as a young lad with a simple axiom. We call it the KISS theory. Keep it simple, stupid. You remember that? Yet everything Washington, D.C. does is yet the opposite of that. It's complex. From the bills that they write, you know how complicated those are. Well, you need attorneys to read them because they're attorneys who write them. It's a game of attorneys. Really, to the way they communicate with their constituents. Half the time, people turn them off because they can't make heads or tails out of what these politicians are saying. Might this be because the Beltway is overflowing with lawyers? The entire makeup of our political system seems to be headed up with lawyers here. Well, let's talk about that next, friends. And this body of Congress, we call one of the most prestigious, although it used to be anyways, political bodies in the world. Lawyers in Congress, a system doomed to fail, perhaps? Joining us here is Captain Stu Swerk. He's here. He's a retired naval officer. He spent a fair amount of time in the Middle East and Western Pacific. He is presently a defense contractor in the beautiful state of South Dakota, and he's a weekly columnist. And one thing about Stu is he always makes you think. And Stu, this piece absolutely made you think here. It's called "The Democrat Party is Made Up of Lawyers," which explains a lot. Is the title of that. You go on to say here, Democrats mock and scorn men who create wealth, like Trump, Bush, and Cheney, or who heal the sick, like Frist, who immerse themselves in history, like Gingrich. The Republican Party is made up of real people doing real work who are often the targets of lawyers. It is interesting, the makeup of this this body here with Republicans and Democrats, the obvious. And you have a lot of names in here. You put the names right in here, the amount of people that Democrats said are lawyers. Is that part and parcel of the biggest challenge we're having in Congress, you think? I mean, the fact that they're all attorneys, I mean, they complicate everything, right?
It's been a topic that's been of interest to me since the early 80s, when I was first handed a copy of Human Events, National Conservative Weekly, which was Ronald Reagan's favorite weekly periodical. Almost the very first article I read was about an organization called the National Lawyers Guild. Now, not too many people know what that's about, but it's a progressive lawyers association that was formed in 1937, almost in parallel with the ACLU. And by the way, both of them were founded by communists. What was the purpose of the NLG? The NLG was intended to essentially go via the legal system to implement progressive policies that would not otherwise pass through a legislative process, through the normal congressional actions, and so forth.
So you sick the attorneys on them if it doesn't pass legislatively, huh?
Exactly. And what they attempted to do is promote progressive legal policies and then essentially capture the Democrat Party, such that some of those progressive lawyers then became intertwined with politicians, either on their staffs or themselves became elected politicians, to a point where, you know, what lawyers do is they always pit people against each other, whether they're right, wrong, or indifferent. A lawyer basically attempts to win a case against another party, depending on whatever the actions are. And so the notion of the divisiveness that we see on the political scene these days, I believe, is largely due to the over-litigation, if you want to call it that, that we've experienced over the last 50 to 60 years, as the lawyers have gone through the legal system. They've had their own Democrat presidents appoint left-wing judges to various different places, and we've seen what the result of that has been in the age of Trump, you know, with some of these left-wing judges in Hawaii and California thwarting national policy, which is outside their own jurisdiction. So, and corruption too. Let's talk about that for a second. One of the key elements of this Russian hoax thing that has been now debunked was a legal outfit called Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie was a Democrat law firm in D.C. that was basically the middleman for paying Fusion GPS for the so-called Steele dossier, which was actually written by Nellie Orr and probably some Russian GRU officers. Nobody knows for sure where it came from, but the point is that legal firm of Perkins Coie has been all around the Democrat Party, representing certain people and doing these kind of middleman pass-throughs to keep when the Clinton administration and the DNC gave money to Perkins Coie, that kept it off the books, to a point where they were able to influence majorly the Trump administration by bogging everything down with the special counsel business. In my mind, that's the essence of corruption right there, to corrupt the political process.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, that's what I mean. It's all doomed to fail, it seems. What I'm saying is, even when you get a guy in there who wants to do the right things and right the ship, I mean, the cards are so stacked against it, Stu, because the operatives, you know, we always refer to the words, we use the words, the deep state, or really it's just entrenched politicians and these political groups, right? That's all it is.
Well, how about this, the latest thing in New York State, where the New York Attorney General is able to get the Trump Foundation fine for $2 million or something like that. It's ludicrous when you compare what the Trump Foundation did, which was altruistic and above board, compared to what the Clinton Foundation is still doing around the world and did to places like Haiti, where they basically took U.S. foreign aid money that was intended to go to Haiti and reprogrammed it through the Clinton Foundation and dispersed to Democrats. I mean, the fact that a Democrat attorney general in the state of New York took a vindictive case against the president, you know, is just indicative of how the progressive lawyers have corrupted the political process in the U.S.
Yeah, it's a perfect example. The president was outraged with that. We heard him this past week about exactly that. That's a great point to bring up, Stu, and the outrage where he pointed out the Clinton Foundation as well and the corruptness there. But it's almost never a tit for tat, but that's where a lot of these people have become entrenched into the system, and they are a big part of the problem, actually. Why Washington is so layered down in bureaucracy and legalities and legalese and all of that.
I'm not saying that all lawyers are bad necessarily. Obviously, there's a place for lawyers to handle certain kinds of things, but but by and large, you know, the trial attorneys in particular are mostly Democrats. They give to the Democrat Party, and what do trial attorneys do? I mean, they basically learn how to lie. Whether there's truth or whether there's fiction, depending on what circumstance they're going after, they learn how to equivocate, because to them the goal is to win at any cost in the courtroom. When you're trained to lie, it's an easy segue to become a politician, because that's what politicians do. They lie. Okay. So, you know, if you're a lawyer, it's kind of like a training ground for becoming a politician by and large.
I can't top any of that, buddy. That's so spot on. It rattles my mind as you think about this more and more and more with the public. You know, it's another interesting stat you have in here, by the way. You say the United States, listen to this stat, people, you'll love this. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population and 66% of the world's lawyers. Now, what the hell does that tell you?
It tells you that there are a lot of people who have gotten on board with the litigious society aspect of how the U.S. has evolved in the last 50 or 60 years. I mean, people sue each other for almost anything these days. I mean, everything is wrapped up in the court system. It's not just criminals. It's neighbors against each other, or, you know, I'm going to sue you, or whatever. And we have all these law-oriented shows on TV that perpetuate some of that nonsense. It's just the way things have trended. So, you know, when people think that becoming a lawyer is a good way to make money too.
The other thing is, I thought coming into this conversation with you today, Stu, I was also thinking the same thing you just said moments ago. You said, well, you know, there are good lawyers out there, and it's not like we're trying to, and I totally agree with that statement. You know, every industry has its sore spots and can be saturated at times with the evildoers, and of course the lawyers' party, because of the way it plays to the political circles, seems to be prime for that, Stu. It's at the top of the heap here. Now, interestingly enough, you also say here, when you see that, listen to this here now, when you see that 97% of the political contributions from the American Trial Lawyers Association go to the Democrat Party, then you'll realize who is responsible for our medical and products costs being so high. That's a hell of a number there, Stu. That says plenty, doesn't it?
Exactly. One of the key topics related to that the trial lawyers are concerned about is tort reform. They don't want tort reform, because if you have tort reform, that cuts down on their fees. So, you know, if we had tort reform, we might be able to resolve some of our medical issues and some of the other...
Amen.
Minimize some of the lawsuits. I mean, people are concerned about the cost of medical care and so forth. Well, you have to factor in legal fees and insurance that doctors and people in the medical industry have to pay to protect themselves against lawsuits. Okay, so it's a self-priming pump to set tort reform aside for the Trial Lawyers Association. So you know darn well those guys don't want to see it. And their Democrat friends will never allow tort reform if they could squelch it.
Listen, there is some good news here, though, a little bit. You say here, what appears to be for the first time ever, lawyers are in the minority in the world's greatest deliberative body, the House of Representatives again, which I said earlier, where they fell into the minority in the late 70s. Lawyers are now down to just a third of the total. So maybe there is hope, Stu. What do you think?
There are people that are kind of waking up to the fact that lawyers are not really productive people. They're more, you know, I hate to use the word because I don't think all lawyers are like this, but quite frankly, they're not, you know, they don't build, they don't produce. They're more like the leech type of a critter than they are anything else. They're not builders. So more people are waking up to that fact. More people snicker and laugh at lawyer jokes and tell them all the time. So maybe that has to do with it. Maybe our culture is learning the fact that a little bit that lawyers aren't really necessarily operating in our best interests, and they can flip and flop and change things. So perhaps in general, we're figuring out it as a people that it's better to be represented by folks that actually have worked for a living and understand capitalism and what have you.
That's it. That's exactly it.
That's a positive way to look at it. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I don't.
Yeah. Friends, go read the column, the article. It's a great read here, and it's entitled "The Democrat Party is Made Up of Lawyers," which explains a lot. And you'll see it right at the top there on AmericaOutloud.com with all the great write-ins and a lot of stuff going on there, friends there. Big thank you here to Captain Stu Swirk. Always great to have him on and get a perspective. As we're now talking about corruption and Congress and what have you, let's turn the page just slightly here. How about the cartels? You see that horrific, horrific story down in Mexico at the border there. Well, we've got two experts coming up next here. Corruption and death at the border. So what about these cartels and how much are they impacting here in America? More Viewpoint in just a moment.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@AmericaOutloud.com.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. This story that you've all seen and seen the gruesome images and videos of this attack on this these American citizens in Mexico, absolutely horrendous. Nothing, you can't even put your arms or your mind around it clearly. But you know, what I want to say to you is that when you see this that's going on from the cartels down in Mexico and you see, well, how rare is this? And you know what, people? This kind of thing goes on more often than you think. And like a lot of things, they're just out of our purview. We don't see them in the public square. We don't see them being reported in the media, the news. But friends, don't think that this stuff doesn't go on a regular basis. It does. Now, the question here is, why did the Mexican cartels do this? Usually they stay away from, again, American citizens or anyone associated with the country in fear of a spotlight that's put on this. That's exactly what's happened here. So let's talk about that next here. Corruption and death at the border. What's behind all these cartels and how big of a problem is this? Joining us here in this segment, Dr. Ron Martinelli. Dr. Martinelli is a retired police detective, a forensic criminologist, and a national voice known as the expert's expert. You see him on the platform here at America Out Loud. Also with his show with Linda in the evenings there, Talking While Married is a favorite. His book, The Truth Behind the Black Lives Matter Movement and the War on Police, is certainly a must read on Amazon and the America Out Loud bookstore, friends. Joining as well is Bob Prevot. He's a retired homicide lieutenant and a former manager of one of the nation's regional high-impact drug trafficking agencies. As a homicide investigator and narcotics supervisor, it's good to have Dr. Ron and Bob here. All right, this was a horrendous attack that it's hard for any reasonable person to really put their mind around. Ron, this kind of a thing, when you see the images, you see the videos, let's start with how common is this kind of an attack? And I'm talking about just with the cartels themselves. Many people would argue this is kind of business as usual for them.
Yeah, well, it is. With the Mexican people, it's business as usual. The kidnapping, the assassinations, the large-scale gunfights, the collateral damage of civilians, with Mexican nationals. But it's very infrequent with Americans. And the reason is, Malcolm, just like you said, they want to stay underneath the radar screen, which is with respect to the American government. They really don't want to trifle with the American government by doing something like this. So this, I think eventually we're going to find that this is an offshoot of one of the cartels, a violent offshoot. And this is, we're going to find out one of two things, a territorial war, mm-hmm. or number two, are they making a statement against the LeBaron family, the Mormon family that was assassinated? Was this a direct intended hit? Because they have fought against the cartels in the past.
So what everybody needs to understand is that there are these routes that come through Mexico, these narcotic routes, as I understand. And again, this is not my area of expertise by any stretch, but I know it is yours. But these routes come up through Mexico into the United States, and there's a lot of territorial problems within these cartels. And they're running ship here. I mean, they run these routes, Bob, from what I understand, I mean, this is a billions with a B. Like, this is mega money here for these groups and their associates and what have you, isn't it? And is that the problem? Is this territorial conflicts and stuff they have?
If we go back to the 70s and we start talking about black tar heroin, we knew where the distribution centers were in the United States and how it was routed. And it was no secret then. It's no secret now how they're doing it. And yes, there's a lot of competition between the cartels on who gets what territory. And basically, we know the routes, and it's just a matter of getting enough enforcement in there to do something about it. And as you know, we're having a lot of problems at the border. We're trying to fix it. But everybody's aware.
Well, Bob, let me ask you that about the border now. How much of an impact is that on the cartels? Now, what I've read a lot of backstories on the fact that the cartels are not happy with, obviously, everything President has Trump and stopping the border there and the activities has really hurt a lot of their business and getting things in here. How does that play into this, Bob?
Even the border walls that we've done so far has had an impact, not only on the drugs, but the human trafficking. So obviously the border wall is going to be a good impact if we can allow it to continue and be completed.
Listen, we all know they're big in Mexico. We know that they run, let's talk about the relationship between the Mexican cartels and the Mexican government. How scared, like you take President Obrador, the Mexican president, who's not been in office very long, in fact, he does not seem to be, in my view anyways, Ron, doesn't come across with a show of force. I don't get a show of strength when he talks about the cartels. He seems to be real quiet. It's just I don't know if that's just me or what, but he almost like a whimper. Are they running the ship down there? Are they running the program? And is he scared of the cartels?
President Obrador, in talking with Mexicans that we know down there, is that he's very popular. Okay, he's a populist president. He's the former mayor of Mexico City, and he comes from a academic background. So he's going to be more liberal and less pragmatic than his predecessors, Nieto and Fox and Salinas before him. And so I just think that he's looking at this the wrong way. He has this, hugs, not bullets philosophy, and it's clearly, clearly, clearly not working. You can't do this with the cartels. You empower them, you enable them when you do this. But he's got decades and decades of corruption, political corruption, police corruption to deal with. Do I think that he's possibly scared of the cartels? Well, I think anybody that's not scared of the cartels is foolish, because it doesn't matter how powerful you are. They've already proven if they wanted to reach out and hurt you, they can reach out and hurt you.
Bob, let's step back a moment and look at this big picture here, because a lot of us don't really understand the ramifications of the drugs coming into America that these drug cartels profit from. Take a moment and tell us, so listeners understand, what are we talking here? How far is the reach of all this when it comes to these Mexican cartels, and how does that impact the cartels here in America?
Well, the reach is obviously national. Every state is impacted. If you go back in time, you know, we had the heroin, we had the crack cocaine, we've had the meth, you know, now we have the opioid epidemic, and it's just one thing after another. And we need to start adapting to this, because, as you know, it's just ruining many thousands and thousands of lives in this country, and it's all because of what's coming into this country.
Yeah. I mean, the drugs, it's hard. I for one, have a hard time, Bob, wrapping my mind around the drug problem. But it's a massive, and all this crime and a lot of the stuff we're talking about, really, would you agree, a lot of it just comes from the pure flow of drugs. Is that correct?
We're allowing the flow of illegals to come in here. We're allowing the drugs to come in here. It's reached every state in the country. We have medical problems. We have, young kids dying from this stuff. And I don't see any way it's going to stop in the immediate future until we get something done with the border and keep these people out. As far as what's going on in Mexico, you can call these people gangs, terrorists, cartels, mafia, mobs. You can call them anything you want. Basically, what they do is they do something illegal. They make a lot of money, and they buy law enforcement, and they buy the elected officials, and they're just allowed to run any way they want. It's not much different than what Al Capone did in Chicago. He made a lot of money illegally. He bought all the politicians, the police, and he was able to go any way he wanted to until somebody thought outside the box and thought about tax evasion. We need to think outside the box and come up with a plan to beat these cartels down in Mexico. You know, we did covert operation in Colombia, and we got rid of them. We just did an operation in ISIS, took out the head of ISIS, took over the oil fields, which cut off their revenue. If they don't have the revenue, they can't get the power.
Which is what the president was alluding to, President Trump, I'm speaking about now. He offered a hand to President Obrador in Mexico, and he said, we're ready to stand to help. President Obrador came back, and he said he refused the help. And a lot of people were questioning that. Ron, was that a realistic offer from President Trump, really, or was it, you know, because the moment was very very passionate. You know, there's a lot of compassion with the death of that family and all the kids. I mean, murdering innocent kids and women and all of this in the way that it was done. Would that ever happen? I mean, I don't really see the Mexican president ever given rein to work in a partnership with us. I mean, that would show that he would admit he's been defeated. I mean, that would not be a show of strength, right? I mean, it's not going to happen.
You know, everybody, when you see something like this horrific massacre of the LeBaron family, everybody's going to have an emotional response. Okay. But I'm very much in agreement with Bob. This is ultimately all about money and power. And if you can cut off the revenue sources, then you reduce the power. But, you know, Obrador has doubled down on this thing. But I think eventually it's going to be a political pressure solution. They'll lose so many more Mexican nationals with his current strategy, which is, I can tell you from the beginning, is going to fail because we're already seeing that it's had no impact on the cartels. I think eventually both countries have to understand that we are such blended countries that whatever serves Mexico serves the United States. We have to deal with this multi-phasic strategy of an economic strategy, a political strategy, and then a military confrontational.
The step that you say there right now is really important people understand here. So listen, as we talk about wars and terrorists and things that are happening in Syria and in Afghanistan, the Middle East, and so on and so forth, friends, the war that's happening right here in Mexico that we're speaking of right now has more real-time ramifications for the American people, I think, because it's right here at the border. And as Bob and Ron are saying, that stuff is leaking right through here. We're one blended community, is what Ron says here. This is interesting stat. Listen to this, people. This is eye-opening to me. Every year, approximately one half of all the tens of thousands of murders occurring in Mexico are committed by members of drug cartels. So you want to talk about influence people, and you want to talk about the terror they reign in there? I mean, that's significant right there. But also another piece of this, which is another major factor, is human trafficking. And it rattles the mind again, the evil that is out there and what they do here. Dr. Ron Martinelli has an outstanding must-read article on the platform right now as I am speaking to you right this moment here. Go look at it here. It's called An Argument for Redefining Drug Cartels as international terrorist groups. So, Ron, you say here, acts of terrorism are not only committed for political gain, terrorism is also used to achieve social objectives, which means that would include like making illegal drugs available for human consumption, changing the social landscape by addicting people to dangerous drugs, creating mass drug addictions, or creating a circumstance where governments legalize gateway drugs, get a load of this, people, such as marijuana, which are sold by transnational distributors of illegal drugs. You can see where this whole thing is going and the social objectives of what's been happening here in America. The point that you say, Ron, redefining drug cartels as international terrorist groups, what would that change by doing that specifically?
Well, that'd be a huge paradigm change. And again, going back to what Bob is saying, is that if once we make them a terrorist organization, then there's a lot more things politically and economically that we can do, just like we did in Colombia. And so we can seize the drug assets internationally, which is huge for us to be able to do. Then labeling them as a terrorist organization, and with the permission of Mexico, we can take the fight to the cartels. Now, Obregón is very concerned about that, but he looks at it in the context of how the Mexican government has unsuccessfully dealt with the cartels militarily in the past. Okay, once the force of the United States is allowed to be introduced into Mexico, we can target every one of these cartel leaders and basically take them out. Okay, yeah. We can go in and get al-Baghdadi. Believe me, we can. That's right. You know, we can get every single one of these cartel leaders and their associates.
So, if they did take President Trump up on that, that could be very successful, Ron. You're saying?
Oh yeah, it could. I mean, and you know, you have to look at what harm could it do, because the Mexicans are losing over, you know, I think something like 35 to 36,000 people a year. Wow. And I wrote about that in the article. And then think of the tens of thousands of people that we are losing in the United States every year from drug addiction,
from drugs,
and gang-related crime. Yeah, look at this.
So could that ever happen?
Well, I think if people understand, but with both countries, that we are really a blended country now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I live in Texas. I mean, you can't think of a more blended a Mexican and American atmosphere than Texas. And look at the huge problems that we have with human trafficking and drugs in Texas alone. I mean, one of the major roots of human trafficking comes right through San Antonio, Texas.
That's right. Bob, what is the factual extent of violence and terrorism committed by transnational organized crime cartels in Mexico? And of course, as we just talked about, the impact here in America. Speak about that.
The impact has been actually devastating. And like I said before, it's affected every single state. And what we need to do is to, like Ron just said, take the fight to them. And I don't mean have a press conference or use Twitter. I mean covertly do what we've done before and just take care of business. And it's going to be in cooperation with the Mexican government. But I think we don't need the press. We don't need anything else. Just go in and covertly get it done. And we certainly have the capability to do it.
Yeah. Wow. Very good. Well, great conversation here. I need to have both of these guys back and talk about this. I find this conversation, this topic most fascinating and interesting to understand what we could do about this, people. Big thank you to Bob Prevost and Dr. Ron Martinelli. It's all back at AmericaOutLoud.com. We are the voice and vision of truth here. Do stay connected with us. And every day it changes there. We are a new version, certainly, of the 6 o'clock news, except you'll get it every hour on the hour here at America Out Loud. Friends, thanks for being part of the journey here. It's time to get involved and get loud.